When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Are you a freak? I should be maybe a little more specific. Are you a Sheetz freak? Dan Sheetz is the owner and the founder of Sheetz Freaks LLC, which is an online community dedicated to helping young people make smart financial decisions. Yes, that's not an oxymoron. It can happen. The author of First to a Million. It's a teenager's guide to achieving early financial freedom. He's a high school business marketing teacher. I didn't even know they teach marketing in high school anymore. He's a real estate investor. He's a personal finance guy, advocate. And his mission is to teach young people the freakish money skills it takes to reach early financial independence. He wants kids, teenagers, to master specific methods of saving and earning and extra income, investing, getting creative how to earn income, which you're going to hear about here on today's episode, and setting them on track to purchase real estate investment properties in their early 20s. And if you're not a teenager tuning in to the Retire Sooner podcast, this is awesome perspective for your kids. But quite simply, Dan is the man. As a father of four boys, I devoured this guy's book. I was doing post-it notes and highlighters because the information around how to talk to your kids about money, what you should be talking to your kids about money, I really found fascinating and got a lot out of this. We all want financial independence for our kids. Dan wants to help with that. And I think today's episode will do just that.
I'm Wes Moss. The prevailing thought in America is that you'll never have enough money and it's almost impossible to retire early. Actually, I think the opposite is true. For more than 20 years, I've been researching, studying, and advising American families, including those who started late, on how to retire sooner and happier. So my mission with the Retire Sooner podcast is to help a million people retire earlier while enjoying the adventure along the way. I'd love for you to be one of them. Let's get started.
Dan Sheetz, thank you for this book.
Yeah.
Actually, I have sticky notes here.
Oh, good. Good.
I'm looking at some of these chapters that I love. Chapter 4 is on money and happiness, which I'm a big advocate around studying that. I loved the reminder of the hedonic adaptation about how we adjust when it comes to money, good or bad, I guess, hedonic, we adjust for money in both ways, right? Well, you know what? Let's start there. I'm going to just ask you right out of the gate. What is hedonic adaptation when it comes to money from Dan Sheetz?
Yeah. So hedonic adaptation is the way I interpret it. It's about a happiness level and your happiness level will go up and down over time because of different events and activities and happenings in your life. It's not always, you know, it's not directly tied with money. It's just your overall happiness. And what it says is that, you know, if like on a scale of 1 to 10, if you're a 7 on the happiness scale on average, then something might happen to, you might have a really good day or a week and you might be up at a 9 or 10, but you're going to come back to that level 7. And if something really traumatic happens or you have a bad week, you're going to go down from that average, but you're going to come back to your average. So it's just kind of a...
And as it relates to baseline, so as it relates back to money,
yes,
you $10,000 plops in your lap, you're a normal 7.5, that day you may go to an 8.5, but then it goes back to a 7.5 once it kind of settles.
Yeah.
In. Yeah.
I mean, look at the number of very wealthy people who are extremely unhappy. And then you can also go to the other end and look at people who have virtually nothing who are extremely happy. It's more about a mindset than a wealth number.
So Dan, you've been a teacher for 20 years plus, or almost 20 years. I think teaching is one of the hardest jobs because it's like a marathon, but it's forever. It never ends. You're going to class, you're teaching. You're going to class, you're teaching. It's like It doesn't end. And you got to kind of be on and kind of be able to navigate and perform, whether it's high school kids. I think you're more high school, but what have you mostly during your almost 20-year career as a teacher, what have you mostly spent time teaching?
Mostly I spend time teaching marketing classes, but I've taught personal finance and entrepreneurship as well. And right now I'm teaching a couple computer classes. But what you said, Wes, is true. Like when you're in the school year, it is a grind, but one of the many great things about being a public school teacher or a teacher of any kind is that during the summer, you get to completely reboot. Everything on your to-do list is done. You know, unless you're teaching summer school or you want to take some classes, but as far as the classes you've taught, they are done and they are wrapped up, and you get a couple months off and then you get to restart the process, which is a benefit not many people get, to just kind of have a point in time once a year where they say, okay, everything is done. It's pretty nice.
Yeah, to some extent, it's a real grind while you're in season, but you get a good, probably a solid 2 months off, or is it a little more than that?
In my district, it's about 2 months in a week.
Okay.
For summer. Yeah.
Now it feels like there's some places around the country where that bleeds late. So school's out, but then you still got to go in for a while and then you got to come back early. And I felt as over the years, the window of time of being out of school has gotten smaller and smaller. But in your case, though, and this is Denver Public Schools, it sounds like you still have a good 8 to 9 weeks, which is pretty awesome.
Yes, solid nine. And I teach I don't teach in the Denver Public School District. I teach in a district just outside of Denver, but we all kind of have the same schedule here.
So marketing classes, finance classes, entrepreneurship classes. I don't remember in high school having any of those. I don't remember marketing in high school.
Yeah.
And entrepreneurship.
I didn't have them either. Yeah. And I would say it's the last 15, 20, maybe longer, a lot of different business classes have been introduced into high schools, but mostly it's the larger high schools, right? In your rural communities, they don't have the luxury of enough enrollment and enough students to offer some more niche classes. But in a large school or the larger schools in our urban areas, you know, they have enough of a student population where they can offer, let's say, one section of entrepreneurship and it'll fill up with 25 or 30 kids. In my high school, I took accounting. We had that business class, and then we had, I think, typing or keyboarding, and that was it. But now your larger high schools will have a nice variety of, and not just business, but other electives. They offer a nice variety of classes.
You know, I'm thinking here as you're talking about you've got this 2 month reset period of time. Has that played in a bunch? I mean, you're essentially as an investor, would you say you're kind of real estate first? Is your main focus been real estate? And tell me just a little bit about that.
Definitely real estate heavy. My wife and I, our overall portfolio, I would say is 80% real estate, 20% other. And most of that other is index funds and stock market. And we really got into the real estate part of it, I'd say 7 years ago.
And that you have what? You've got an Airbnb, you've got single family, multifamily, you do buy, rehab, rent, refinance, repeat. What was your first step into that?
Into the real estate stuff. Yeah. My first one is like many people, I kind of became an accidental landlord. I bought my first property right around age 30, and it was a 2-bedroom townhome. And I actually ended up doing the strategy called house hacking, although back then I didn't know what it was. I had a friend that was moving to Colorado from Texas, so he rented out one of the bedrooms, paid me rent, and that was really helpful. But then I ended up moving out of that place, and so I had a decision to make. Do I want to keep it or do I want to sell it? And at that time, this was maybe 2011, and after the 2008 market crash, the value was, I was underwater on that property. So yeah, I either had really two choices, foreclose or keep it. So I kept it and turned it into a rental, hoping that it would someday come back to the value that I bought it for, which it did, and actually a little bit more. I sold that about 7 years ago. That was my first accidental trip into real estate investing.
And you did it at a tough time, but it eventually rebounded from the great financial crisis. And then What has been the strategy for you guys, you and your wife, over the last couple of years? Is it one, is it when opportunities present themselves and they show great value? Or do you kind of have a goal where you want to do something new once every year, a couple of years? What is your financial plan when it comes to this?
For real estate, it's, you know, we have discussions all the time and we change paths. We change our focus probably more than we should, but the last couple of years we've more recently gone out of state. We live in a suburb of Denver, Colorado. Colorado real estate market is on fire, as are other places. So we went to a suburb of Detroit, Michigan, where real estate was much less expensive, and we're buying single family homes out there. We bought three, and those have gone well. And then most recently, our last investment, we actually bought into like a, I'll call it a syndication, but it wasn't a legal syndication. It was buying a share of a short-term rental property with some other people. And that one is down in Las Vegas, but a management company, they find it, they buy it, they rehab it, they do all the short-term rental management, and then investors, you know, buy a percentage of that property, which is what we did. And so we're hoping that works out well.
So you are not necessarily just staying to your backyard. So Colorado got a little expensive and you said, well, where is there some good value? And you found it outside of Detroit, you found something in Vegas. How did you, as an example, how'd you end up in Michigan?
At the time, we were looking at a couple different places to invest out of state. And I think we narrowed it down to Florida and Michigan. And the deciding factor for us was that we had some close friends that lived right near where we were looking at. And so our thought was, well, if we're going to go out of state and we needed someone to run over to our property, you know, in an emergency or check something out for us, then we can call on our friends. And so that was like kind of a safety net. Now I will say we never, ever did that. We never had to call them and had them go check on anything.
So it was like a security blanket you didn't really need.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, there's good deals to be found in pretty much every market. We just happened to choose Detroit.
Who manages that now? Who is the day-to-day collector? What is the percentage you have to pay on those properties when it comes to rent and management?
Yeah, we have a small property management company that handles those three houses for us. I think because we have more than one, they give us a little bit of a discount. I think it's 9% of gross rent is theirs. Plus, every time they have to flip it and they find a new tenant, they take, I think, the first month's rent as a fee, which is pretty standard.
Yeah.
We don't really do a whole lot with those.
All right. I'm going to raise this book up. And I guess if you're listening, you're not seeing it, but we're seeing it here. Dan's book is First to a Million. Who is the first person that gets to a million? And how many kids in their teens are really thinking about this?
It's not a lot, right? And so I'm trying to change that. I think my main goal would be to say, I think every young person, I think everybody, but my niche is what I call, you know, like Gen Z, 15 to 25. I think they all should know that there are other options than the typical American dream pathway of 9 to 5 till you're 65, that grind. And so I'm just presenting them with more information and options and then letting them decide what they want to do. So my book, First to a Million, the subtitle is A Teenager's Guide to Achieving Early Financial Independence. So it is for a very motivated young person who is interested in their financial future enough to read a book. In other ways, I try to incentivize and motivate young people to at least learn the information. And then if they put it into action now, great. If they put it into action 10 or 15, 20 years down the road, that's fine too. That seed will blossom when it's meant to. But at least now they have the information.
So again, I've gone through a lot of this book. I've got a bunch of sticky notes here. In my green highlighter, I've got the Can Money Buy Happiness? I think I have something at some point titled something similar to that, Can Money Buy Happiness? In my world, I call it the plateau effect, where essentially I see levels of happiness rise early on in financial accumulation, and then they essentially plateau out once we get to a certain point, an inflection point. What are the five things that you would give as a takeaway to our audience to tell their kids, or if you're 18 and listening, what are the five things to end up with getting to a million first?
Good question. And I can answer that one pretty simply. So I get asked quite often, what's the one important thing, most important thing you would want someone to take from your book? And so I'll start with that. Number one, I would say the habit of paying yourself first is, I think, the most important thing that someone can take from my book, which in a nutshell is just, you know, every dollar that comes into your life, a certain percentage of that automatically first goes into your, to your future self. You're paying that bill to your future self. So savings and investing. That would be the first thing. And the remaining four, I would just say, are what I call my four mechanisms for early financial independence that the book spends most of the time talking about. And those are, number one, earn more; two, spend less; three, save the difference; and four, invest your savings wisely. And so employing those four levers, mechanisms, combined with paying yourself first, you are, it's just math. You are guaranteed to get to financial independence well before 65.
So let's talk about earning more. How do you advocate earning more? Is it have multiple jobs? Is it start your own business? Is it go to Wall Street and go work for a hedge fund? Is it go into commercial real estate where your upside is, you know, massive? When you say earn more, what do you mean by that?
So for, yeah, the readers of the book and the members in my community being young, it's really about, you know, in the summer, like, so let's say high school, college, maybe they went to college, maybe they didn't, but in the summer, you at least have a full-time job. During school, you have a part-time job. And then beyond that, you know, some kind of a side hustle, starting your own business, absolutely. Finding some other way to make income. It could even be just selling a few items that they own that they no longer use or value, like a guitar, for instance. You know, I had a student recently who had a guitar for 10 years, loved it 10 years ago. They never touch it. And so sell that on Facebook Marketplace, get $50, whatever it might be, and put that towards your future self. That's kind of an extra income stream. I mean, to a point, you can't sell everything you have, but, you know, be creative with side hustles, entrepreneurship, even creating passive income at a young age is completely possible. So all of that combined, just figure out one or two ways to really maximize your income, even if you're young.
You know, I'm interested to hear maybe just some examples. What have you seen in the last 5 years, 10 years of the kind of the teen and young adult economy, that if you're going to have a new business, what does it look like today? Whereas 20 years ago, you know, what did I do? I had a painting business. I outdoor painting was, you know, maybe a popular franchise type of thing 20 some years ago.
Yes. I mean, some of the tried and true self, like side hustles, are still very, very accurate. Like, you know, I have people in my community that do lawn care, yeah, that do pet sitting, that do babysitting. One of my members, this was somewhat creative, but he built a few different yard games, like cornhole, and there's another, I forget the name of it, but he has a few different yard games that he's built. And he just, on, I think it's Facebook Marketplace, offers rentals. So he will, someone rents some of these games from him for a birthday party or a reunion or something. He'll drive there, set everything up, come back afterwards, get everything and take it home, and, you know, makes a little money doing that. And all the way up to like more modern examples, one of my members created an online course for, he had a side hustle, which was couch flipping, created an online course for young people or anyone, I guess.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. You know, what's couch flipping? Is that
couch flipping?
What is couch flipping?
So it's a side hustle.
Like, sounds like cow tipping, but couch flipping. What is that?
Very different. Very different. So couch flipping is in a nutshell, finding couches for sale that are either very cheap or free. Oftentimes, sometimes people will say, if you come pick this couch up from me, you can have it. Here it is for free. So it generally requires like a pickup or some kind of a larger vehicle, which my member Ethan had. He had a pickup, so he would drive there, get the couch, take it home, steam clean it, maybe some minor repairs, freshen it up a little bit, list it on Facebook Marketplace and say, I have this great couch, I will deliver it to you, which is a huge thing, right? Most people don't have a means to pick up a couch. And, you know, he makes $200, $300, sometimes up to $500 per couch flipping these. And he also had to convince his parents, because he's in high school, to allow him to take up garage space, because he at times would have three or four couches in the garage. So they weren't parking in the garage anymore. But he was making really good money and it was going so well. Other members of the community started asking him about it. And he said, you know what? I should just create an online course. And he did. And I forget what platform it's on, but now he makes passive income. People buy his online couch flipping course for $75. I don't know what it is. And he's a senior in high school now.
That is awesome. I could see that as a great, I'm surprised that private equity funds haven't bought that up. I mean, couch rehab is an amazing idea. It really is.
Yeah, people do the same thing with cars. You can flip a lot of items. Couches is really nice because most people don't want to move them, don't want to lift them. And so they're willing to pay a premium for someone who is willing to do the grunt work.
Yeah, I can see. It's almost like if your dirty old couch in your house has kind of lived through the grind of just, it, you know how much has been spilled on it or the grossness of it, but it's almost like you're giving the couch a second life, steam clean, new home. It goes from like, get it out of my house, like I'll pay you to get rid of it, to, oh, that's probably worth like $500. So that's pretty cool. That is creative. That's new. They didn't have, so that's something that we didn't have 20 years ago because of Facebook Marketplace, et cetera.
Yeah. Well, and the online course part of it too, wasn't around 20 years ago either. You know, that extra revenue stream for him.
Yeah, and which I guess is ultra passive, right? Because it's done, you do it once, and then you collect checks as many times as people, I guess, order it.
Hey, y'all, it's Mallory Boggs, the producer for the Retire Sooner podcast. From an investment standpoint, the world is changing. We've gone from no inflation to hyperinflation, zero interest rates to much higher interest rates. All of this changes the dynamics for stocks and bonds. So the question for you, are your retirement accounts ready for it? Have you adapted your investments for these major shifts? Do you know what kind of income your 401k account is going to pay you in retirement? If not, maybe it's time for a new perspective. The Retire Sooner team is here to help. If you're ready to talk, reach out to our team and we'll help you take a closer look at how you can generate income in retirement and protect yourself from inflation. We'd love to hear from you. Again, find us at wesmoss.com. That's WESMOSS.com.
So you've got pay yourself first. I love the thought of earning more. Now, spending less, though, is just plain tough, right? We're in huge inflation. You've got teenagers that are headed to college or somewhere, and expenses are high. That is, it seems like on your list in the early goings, Dan, maybe the toughest one. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's toughest, but it's probably the one with the least bang for their buck, right? Because teenagers, they don't spend a lot of money as is. If they're living at home, eating at home, maybe parents are taking care of their cell phone bill, their health insurance, they don't have a lot of expenses. And so the book talks about frugality and let's keep it there, right? Live that college lifestyle, if you will, of having roommates, eating inexpensive food, not going out, not buying new clothes. Keep that lifestyle for as long as you can. Avoid the lifestyle inflation. So let's say you graduate from high school, college, and you get your first full-time, you know, legitimate job, perhaps a salary job. Don't go out and buy the brand new car. Don't go out and rent the nicest condo in the nicest neighborhood that you can afford. Stay living out a frugal lifestyle, still spending on things you value, absolutely. But don't spend the money on things you don't value so that you can widen that savings gap, which then increases your saving and investing and gets you to financial independence faster.
You know, this is, goes back to kind of the current environment when it comes to real estate. You're, as a real estate professional or as a huge part of your overall financial plan, what do you think is going to happen over the next year as rates are a lot higher? I just recently have started to hear my real estate clients that have seen their volumes go from a lot to very little, not a lot of transactions. Mortgage rates are a lot higher. Do you think that that is just part of the cycle? We give it a year or two before things kind of maybe correct a little bit in housing prices and they become more affordable. What's your gut on real estate market?
Yeah, I think overall, it's hard to pin down because every market's a little different. But so I'll speak to what I know the best, the Denver metro market. I know that here there is a severe housing shortage. Mm-hmm. And I mean severe housing shortage. And when you get into affordable housing, it's even worse. There's just not enough supply and a very high demand because people are actually moving to Denver faster than people are moving out. We're growing. And so just based on simple economics, supply and demand, real estate prices in the Denver metro area, generally speaking, are not going to go down. They may level out, or I think they'll slowly start continue to increase, but I don't think they're going to go down. And again, every market's different, but I read a study a couple years ago that puts a lot of things in perspective here that people are missing about the real estate market. And that is that over the last 30 to 40 years, the average time on the market for a property, we're talking about United States, all markets, all price levels, the average is 6 months. And I can remember a time very early in my life when if you put a house for sale and it sat for a year, that wasn't like
that crazy. Yeah.
It wasn't that crazy. It was not great, but it wasn't that crazy. So 6 months is the average. And in the Denver metro area for a long time, several years, we've been hovering around that 1 month of inventory.
Yeah.
The average house is on inventory for 1 month. And now we're starting to kind of fall back a little bit to like maybe 6 weeks. And people are freaking out like, wow, this is going from a buyer's market now to a seller's market. I'm like, no. We got a long way to go to get to the neutral zone, which is 6 months. It is still by far a seller's market in the Denver metro. And I think many of the other major areas around the country.
You know, it feels like it's tough to get kids to respond or pay attention when it comes to a topic like this, because it's long-term. Like kids at an early age, kids see in the world that the media celebrates wealth, right? You know, Forbes 400 list comes out, you know, not a day goes by where you don't hear 10 things about Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos because they're the richest guys, right, in the world or richest people in the world. How do you practically engage teenagers? Like what grabs them when it comes to trying to think longer term about money?
It can be tough. You can't make a teenager do anything they don't want to do. And so you can't make them learn about their financial future, but you can present things in ways that make it more enticing. So for example, that word retire, I never use that in my classroom. I never use that in my community. Instead, I'll say financial freedom or financial independence. That's something they can sink their teeth into a little bit more. That's something that isn't in their mind labeled as, oh, that's something I do when I'm old. Financial freedom is something I can get when I'm young or old. And I won't use even the words personal finance. I'll use, you know, terms that make it like, for example, I had a personal finance club for a while and the attendance wasn't that great. I changed the name to the Future Millionaires Club and boom, we had lots of people, lots of students coming to the meetings. So it's just a lot of it's about phrasing. And a lot of it is math, just
no
simple math.
No wonder you're teaching marketing.
Yes. Yeah, that's my main gig.
You know how to do it. It's the same thing, but wait a minute, words work. They mean they're powerful.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Sign up for Boring Financial Personal Finance or Future Billionaires Club. I mean, I know where I'm going.
I just had this conversation today with the department chair in my school about next year, instead of having the personal finance class called personal finance, can we change the name to something more sexy that will get kids interested in the door? And so we're working on that.
What's your gut idea?
Yeah, you know, something like Future Millionaires Club, but in a class title kind of way, or, you know, Money Matters, Early Financial Independence could be the title of the class. Early Financial Freedom, even better. Yeah, something that's sexy, right? That gets kids to sign up for it.
I love it. All right, how about this? There's a TED Talk that you talk about in the book that helps, I guess, teenagers or kids think about their future purpose. Tell our listeners here on the Retire Sooner podcast about that.
Yeah, there's a TED Talk done by a guy. Lawrence was his name. You might have his last name there in front of you, but he did kind of and he was in high school himself, or at least he was very young. And he did a kind of a study where he asked a bunch of young kids, what do you see yourself doing after high school or college? And then they, you know, a lot of them gave him their answers and things like doctors, lawyers, engineers. Then he went back and asked them, if you could do anything after high school or college, what would you do? And a lot of them, their answers changed, which was a, a sign to Lawrence and I think everyone else that young people are being steered in a direction that maybe they don't want to go based on societal norms, parental influences, teacher influences, and maybe even fears around money. You know, I want to do this, but it's not going to pay enough. So I'm going to go do this instead, which I think is in general, generally speaking, is a bad thing. We want people to do what they're passionate about, what their heart is meant to do. And so finding a way for them to engage in that profession, career, vocation that is meaningful, it is passionate for them, I think is a better way for, it would be better for everyone. Now, that might mean, you know, one pathway might be to earn a high income with a college degree for 10 or 15 years and then reach financial freedom, thus allowing yourself to have the time to do that thing, which is your dream job or start some kind of business. And that can go a lot of different ways, but again, it goes back to just making sure the young people know that there isn't just one way to do this, this thing called life, work till you're 65 and then retire. There are other options.
So for our audience, this was Lawrence Lewars, L-E-W-A-R-S. And the TED Talk is Questions Every Teenager Needs to Be Asked. So this is something as parents listening to the Retire Sooner podcast or reading your book, First to a Million, can encourage their kids to watch. And they start, and they're prompting them to say, hey, what do you think you should be doing in 15 years? Okay, now we'll remove all boundaries and societal norms. And what are you going to do in 15 years? And you get two really interesting answers if you think about it that way. What is your take, Dan, on college? Do you tell me, this is the ever forever debate. College is expensive. It's more expensive than it's ever been. We're getting very little relief around it. You've got this big political football around student loan forgiveness, but no matter which way you slice it, college is a huge financial decision. And what is your take on that? Do you feel like you tell all your kids they have to go to college or absolutely not? Or where do you come down on the debate?
It is an active debate, isn't it? And I think there's a slow pendulum swinging on this very emotional choice for a lot of families of whether someone should go to college or not. And in my book, I have two chapters dedicated to the college question, and they were the toughest chapters to write. But basically, I boiled it down to this. I can't tell anyone what to do as far as, you know, should they go to college or not. But in my book, I lay out the pros and cons of the choice of college based on someone who wants to reach early financial independence. And then I have a second chapter that says, so if you do then decide to go to college, here's the best way to do it. And number one on that list is, if you're going to get a college degree, you need to figure out a way to do it without incurring any student loan debt. That is goal number one. Number two then is, where are you going to go? How are you going to do it? You know, maybe community college first, maybe a two-year degree or certificate, but avoid the college debt.
All right, so hold on. So if you're saying no college debt, Dan, then unless your parents are paying, okay, then that eliminates any, let's say, school you'll see on a Saturday morning in the fall. Like, you're not going to go to a big football school or big state university or out-of-state university because no kid can afford 25 to 40 grand a year, right?
Yeah, I mean, so if the parents can't afford it, many kids do get, you know, a good amount of scholarships based on academics or athletics. So that could be part of the puzzle. And then also, you know, there's so many ways to do post-secondary education that, you could still go to one of those big Saturday schools. If it's an in-state public university and you get some good scholarships and you're also working part-time perhaps, or maybe you take a gap year and you work over the course of a year and save up $30,000, $40,000 and then just start college a year later, you're now kind of ahead of the ball.
Yeah. Or perhaps you're breaking this up where your parents are contributing some. They're working, so they're saying, hey, we're going to help you with some of your tuition. You help with some of the tuition.
Yep.
And then maybe savings. And really, I see that in the real world that gets sliced up. Maybe it's a third savings, a third current working income, and from parents, a third from the from the student.
Exactly. And another option is, if there is a school within driving distance of that student's, where the parents live, then, you know, be a commuter, live at home, eat at home, and avoid the room and board costs of college. Online school, you know, I think after the pandemic, learning online has blown up, and there are a lot of different universities that offer 100% virtual degrees. And so you absolutely can live at home at that point, and perhaps your parents still pay some of your other bills as well. And so every situation is so unique, but that number one goal of graduating without student loan debt, I think, is so important.
How much should we talk to our kids about money? I don't know the answer to this question. I've been in the money business, for financial advisory business, for over two decades. And sometimes I want to be really transparent with my kids, and it's almost goes back to if their responsibility levels and how much they can handle having conversations. But what is your thought on the transparency we should be having with our kids and just talking about money?
My thought is that we should be as open and transparent about money as possible, and we should talk about money as much as possible with our kids.
So would you tell your kids, do you have children?
I have one son, but he is 1 year old.
So he's a little early to talk about a 401k, but
yeah.
Let's say he's 10. Do you tell him what you make per year?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
This is an American mindset of money should be private. Money should be, you know, it should be brushed under the table. We shouldn't be having money conversations with friends, colleagues, coworkers, or even strangers. And I completely disagree with that. If we all were much more open about money, we would all be so much more intelligent with our money. Because every person in my circle, they know things about investing or saving or opportunities or the different things that I don't know. And if we're not having those conversations, how am I supposed to learn what I need to know? I mean, I can read books and stuff, but I would learn so much more if people were open with it. And so, you know, when my son is 10, I will be completely open with him. I don't know if it's 10 exactly, but when he's young, right, he will know all of the income and expenses for our small business that is our household. And, you know, I will say to him probably, you know, if you go to school, don't be, you know, you don't need to be telling everyone this, because you don't want kids talking about how much my daddy makes versus yours. Mm-hmm. But once they get to an age where they're more responsible and mature, I would say high school age, then again, you're not going to go out and just blurt it out to somebody, but have money conversations. They're so important.
I love your take in this book on real assets versus false. I think that probably hits home with teenagers, real versus fake. I like that. What's an example of each category?
Yeah, so false assets, the definition would be an asset that takes money from your net worth or takes money out of your pocket. So a great example would be a car. A car is a false asset. On an accounting ledger sheet, it is listed as an asset because you could sell it for money, but every day that you own it, your net worth goes down because it has expenses, it has depreciation. That's
except
a false
for
asset.
A brief blip during the pandemic, right?
Yes. Yeah. I think even we're still at the tail end of that blip where you could sell your used car possibly for more than you bought it for a few years ago, but that's not normal, right? So a real asset is one that puts money in your pocket that contributes to your net worth. And the best example I love is a real estate investment property. You have to own it, and it makes cash flow. It appreciates over time. You have mortgage pay down, you have tax benefits. So it is an asset that is building your wealth, not taking from it.
This is another thing that I really liked about your book is the difference between income versus wealth, which is chapter 13. I'm going to take my post-it note to that. Income versus wealth, I really like. Can you maybe talk through that a little bit?
Yeah, this was, I think, extra important for young people, and my book is for teens, because in their social media world, what they see is a lot of income. You know, people are buying nice cars and watches and clothes and vacations because, you know, they have a high income perhaps. But what they're not seeing is actual wealth. Wealth is much more difficult to see because wealth is something that we keep, where income is something that you spend. So income is just how much you make. Wealth is how much do you keep, right? What is our net worth, and is it growing? And so knowing the difference and knowing which one is more important, you can build a very healthy, high level of net worth with a low income, and you can have an extremely high income and a negative net worth, perhaps even bankruptcy for some people with high incomes. So it's just about being smart with money.
How much does social media mess kids up? I mean, I think about when I see my kids and they're on TikTok or they're wherever they might be, it's always so far from reality. And a lot of it does have to do with money. There's always some money component about YouTubers making money or contributing to somebody online. Does it make it harder for kids to get down to fundamentals in the real world because they're constantly advertised to online, with which is probably these, you know, 0.1% type people that do happen to really make it online? How tough is that for teens today?
Yeah, I would say the jury's still out, but I would also say that I don't think it's as bad as maybe we adults once thought it was. I mean, I talk to high school kids every day, every day. It's what I do all day, every day. And social media comes up often in our conversations. For today's teenagers, it's mostly Snapchat and TikTok, right? A few years ago, it was mostly Instagram. Before that, Twitter and Facebook. But it'll always keep changing. But I think what I'm finding from the teens I talk to anyway is that they are much more capable of deciphering those messages than perhaps we are even as adults, because it's all they've known. And they've only known this fake world of social media. Now, I'm not saying that every young person handles it in a good way, but I think many more than we thought are able to say, okay, I see this photo, I see this post, it's entertaining, but I know it's fake. And then I see this one over here, and this is more real. They kind of know the difference. Now, unfortunately, there are some that haven't got to that point yet, but I don't think it's as bad as we maybe thought it was going to be a few years ago.
That's actually fascinating. So the kids are 18 today. They're digital natives. They've never known anything but an iPhone/smartphone/ social media. So they're wise to it, maybe more than we had thought, which is a really, really interesting point. Do you teach this concept of the enough concept, the fulfillment curve? Do you talk about that in your classes, which is this money, it kind of relates back to money and happiness? I want to kind of wrap up on that really fun topic.
I absolutely do talk about it in my personal finance classes. And it goes back to what you said earlier in the show, Wes, about happiness kind of plateauing with a certain amount of income. It's the exact same thing. And by the way, the fulfillment curve I took from Your Money or Your Life by Joe Dominguez and Vicky Robin, I renamed it the happiness curve because for my audience, that just made more sense. But yeah, it's the idea that, you know, income can increase to a point and it's correlated with your happiness, but then it actually starts to, like you said, plateau or even go down the higher income that you make. And you really just need enough. I like to say actually enough plus a little, enough to meet your basic needs plus a little bit to have those splurges and spend on things you value lavishly, which we all deserve to do. But beyond that, you know, more money actually, I think, and I don't know, I don't know from a personal experience, but from a lot of what I see out there, high income can cause a lot more stress and a lot more worry than the extra income is adding value to your life.
That's interesting to think about. So it's not just diminishing marginal returns of happiness. You're, to some extent, if you look at your fulfillment curve, you're seeing that really as income keeps going up, it could actually lead to more anxiety.
Yeah. So I gave an example. My buddy bought a boat and a really nice boat. And he, like 3 or 4 years ago, he ended up selling it recently. He's like, it was too stressful to own a boat. I have to worry about storage and maintenance and insurance and theft and accidents and, you know, and this not working and that not working and depreciating it's the license and the trailer. He's like, I just finally said, enough with it. And it's an example of higher income can get you nicer toys, but then you have all these other things to deal with. Not saying you shouldn't have any toys, but there does come a point where adding more to your portfolio, I guess, is actually not adding any happiness.
So maybe we'll kind of end up on a more of a practical note, which is, at what age do you tell your students, should they be getting credit cards? Should they be having bank accounts? Should they be starting retirement accounts? And I assume earlier is typically better, but what is that conversation like? What should parents be doing to get kids in shape financially?
Yeah, great question. Really, really good question. Credit cards, I tell my students and I tell members of my community, and this is going to seem a little scary, but I tell them the day you turn 18, that morning, roll out of bed, go to your laptop and apply for your first credit card. When you turn 19, get your second one. When you turn 19 and a half, get your third credit card and use all three every single month, even if it's just for 10 or 20 bucks. Because every time you make that on-time payment in full, on time, you are building your credit history and thus your credit score. And I have seen young people build credit scores in the upper 700s in less than a year just by having one or two credit cards. It is not that difficult.
No kidding. That quickly. So you can get a 700 credit score by the time you're 19 if you're good.
Yeah. It's so
that's cool.
Surprising because they don't have the length of credit history, but when you have multiple entries, payments in your credit history and they are 100% good, your credit score. Now, if they happen to miss one, right, it's going to ding it a lot more than it would an established creditor, but yeah, so credit cards, you know, and this is all assuming that we've educated and trained this young individual to use them responsibly.
Yeah.
That should go without saying. So we don't want to put credit cards in the hands of an uneducated young person. That's going to be a disaster. Checking accounts and savings accounts, I think, yeah, the earlier the better. I mean, as a parent, if you are a parent, and most, I think, know this, you can go to the bank and open a joint account. You know, they can't open an account unless they're 18, but as a parent, you can open a joint account with your son or daughter, even if they're 6, 7, 8 years old.
Yeah.
And then, you know, designate that as their account, only put their money into it, perhaps get the debit card with their name on it and let them use the debit card to start learning some of the habits around money if you feel they're ready. So I would say savings account and checking account both, even if they're under 18. Here's another trick. If your child is under 18, they cannot get a credit card, but as a parent, you can add a minor as an authorized user on your credit card account, which parents should do, assuming they have good credit and good money habits. Because if that minor is on the account, then the on-time payments for that account also go to the minor's credit history. So when they do turn 18, they're not starting from zero, they're starting from a healthy credit history position. So it actually helps build their score before they're 18.
And so is it actually has a fairly heavy weight, even if they're under 18, or is it formulaically maybe a little bit less than if they were 18?
I don't actually think you can check their credit score prior to being 18, but once they turn 18, you can check it. So it's just building their history. Like they have a history, but their scores don't actually, the bureaus, I don't think, calculate scores until someone's actually 18.
And then I guess the last one here would be retirement accounts.
Hmm.
You guys talk about that in class, even for teenagers?
Oh yeah, we definitely talk about it. I have a different pitch, if you will. You know, when I talk to kids in my classroom, I'm dealing with the average bell curve of students in my classroom. When I deal with young people in my community, which is specifically for young people who are interested in this stuff, then that's a different audience. And so I have a different message for them around retirement accounts. But in general, for most people, putting money into retirement accounts and then investing it is a very good strategy. The comments change when if I have a young person who says, I want to reach financial freedom by age 40 or age 30 or perhaps younger, then a retirement account may not be the best place to put your money because you don't get to access it until you're 59 and a half, right? About 60 years old. And that's much later. And if an opportunity comes your way, like you want to start a business, that money's locked up. And so again, I don't tell them they should or shouldn't. I say, here are the pros and cons of both choices. You get to make your own choice. Maybe you still contribute to a retirement account, but maybe not as much. Yeah.
So there's a lot we can do for our kids. A, we want to be talking to them. I'm getting that from you. And I would agree with you. And I think you have a good point is that the conversations can get more involved the more mature they get, right? You don't want your kids running off and saying, my dad makes this. So as they get more mature, they can handle more. Two, I love all these ideas of just getting credit cards started early, age 18 or as a minor, getting joint accounts set up when you've got a kid that's six, and then retirement accounts. Again, if you're making any sort of income, you can put money in a retirement account, right? So we can put money into a Roth if we're, you know, 18 years old, making any amount of money. As long as we're making something, we can contribute. So, but you're right, there's some pros and cons to that. Let me go back to happiness for just a second, though. What role does happiness, though, with teens play in the money game, getting to a million? Is it, do you correlate those two?
Yeah, the conversations around happiness tend to happen in the beginning of the class or course or in my book, because it's really about realizing, and this is so important, so critical to the overall goal or plans of a young person. If the goal is to be happy, or the happiest you can be, which I think for most people would make sense, then you need to first understand what is it that makes you happy. And so I have my young people make their happiness list, which would be the 10 things. It could be things, people, events, hobbies, items. What are the 10 things in your life that bring you happiness in no particular order, right? So it could be walking my dog, spending time with my friends makes the list almost always, right? I like running. I like reading books. I like being on the beach, whatever it might be. And then once you realize, okay, these are the things that when I'm doing this, I'm really a happy person, then how do I now do more of these things? And generally the answer is, well, I have to find more time, because all of the things on that list generally take time. So getting the freedom of your time back allows you to do the things that make you more happy, thus you are happier. And so striving for early financial freedom, employing those strategies to get to a place where you don't have to work 9 to 5 anymore. You can, if that brings you happiness, but if not, you can go back to that happiness list and say, I love to golf, but instead of golfing once a month now, I'm going to golf once a week. And I would bet that that person's going to be happier. So it's about getting your time back, knowing that that's going to allow you to do the things that make you more happy. And early financial independence strategies will get you to the point where you have your freedom of time.
Yeah, what a cool full circle. I love this perspective, because it's like, when you're talking to a teen, you're trying to help them discover what makes them happy. It's all this list of all these things, but the common denominator is time. So it's really happiness equals time. But in order to get more time to do the happiness list, you have to have some sort of financial freedom / invest / passive income. So it's really happiness equals time equals investing.
Yeah. And the other interesting thing about that happiness list, I'll have my kids, you know, the first thing I'll have them do is, you know, circle anything that costs, anything that is free or low cost. And generally 7 to 10 of those items out of 10 will be circled, meaning that it doesn't cost me money to spend time with my friends. It doesn't cost me money to walk my dog. It doesn't cost me money to go for a run. It doesn't cost me money to read a book. Like, you know, the things that make us happy generally do not cost a ton of money. Some might. And so going back to, you know, it is much more about the freedom of time than having a ton of money, a ton of net worth, that, you know, you only have so much time in the day to do the things that make you happy. Time is what is more, much more important than the net worth.
A lesson for teens and adults alike. Mm-hmm. It's funny, on the Retire Sooner podcast, I always think our guests, if they're good, like Dan, is always talking me into retiring now. So I'm always like, well, wait a minute, maybe I should just retire now. But then I go back to, you know, I always think about that when I have a great interview. I'm like, oh, you're right. I should. I should just be done. But then I go back to my list. My list actually luckily includes working. It's a huge part of my life. And the growth of the business and the people we work with. And it's the podcast, the book. So it is part of that list of, you know, without that on my list, it'd be like I'd have no batteries, right? I'd be an Energizer bunny with no clapping cymbals.
What's interesting is that when people do reach early financial freedom, they are not the type of people who just stop.
Yeah.
That you know, they have to create or produce or serve in some capacity. That's what brings them life, just like you're saying. And the other thing is, so I decided this school year, I actually went from full-time teacher to half-time teacher I guess you'd call that maybe a semi-retirement, because my list of happiness things changed when my son was born a little over a year ago. All of a sudden, at the top of my list is spending time with my wife and son became much more important, because you don't get those years, that time back with your kids. And so I made the decision that I'm only going to teach halftime this year. I'm going to spend the extra time with my family. And luckily, with real estate investing and some other stuff, you know, that we could afford to have a halftime paycheck. I still love teaching, like you, like being involved with teenagers every day is what I really love to do, but I can do it halftime and use the other time to do what makes me happy.
Well, I know that your list includes running, biking, cross country, skiing, bluegrass music festivals, which is cool. You got a good list of core pursuits. But it's funny. People always talk to me about getting some sort of show done for kids. And I always say kids don't really, there's not enough of them care about money, but the reality is they do. More of them do. I think you're living proof that there's an audience for it. And really, to me, this is not just about the kids and what they need to learn. It's what our parents need to help our kids be learning. So today's episode is really for not just teenagers, it's for parents. And I think that's what you bring to the table here in First to a Million. Be different about money. Be bold about your future. Be a financial independence freak. Teenager's Guide to Achieving Early Financial Independence by Dan Sheeks.
Hey, y'all. This is Mallory with the Retire Sooner team. Please be sure to rate and subscribe to this podcast and share it with a friend. If you have any questions, you can find us at wesmoss.com. That's WESMOSS.com. You can also follow us on Instagram and YouTube. You'll find us under the handle Retire Sooner Podcast. And now for our show's disclosure. This podcast is provided to you as a resource for informational purposes only and is not to be viewed as investment advice or recommendations. This information is being presented without consideration of the investment objectives, risk tolerance, or financial circumstances of any specific investor and might not be suitable for all investors. It is not intended to and should not form a primary basis for any investment decision that you may make. Always consult your own legal, tax, or investment advisor before making any investment or financial planning considerations. Please refer to the full disclosure in the podcast description for any additional information.